Having said everything you said, Ryan, what was it that attracted you to going indie, to leaving Apple and setting up Tumult and starting your own products?
Thank you, Renee, for dragging us into what I actually wanted to talk to Ryan about after over an hour and a half of talking with him.
Yeah, hey, that's what happens. So it was kind of an idea. Jonathan is my co-founder. I believe, Guy, you've certainly met him. Renee, I don't know if you have. I haven't met you. So Jonathan Deutsch is my co-founder, and we worked kind of on distantly related teams at Apple for a long period of time. He was in I'm totally blanking on the name now. Soft update verification. I forget the team name that he was on, but it was basically qualifying, testing, qualifying, and ensuring that software updates that were going out wouldn't break shit and worked well. And it was a very interesting, very unique team at Apple, because they hired amazing, fantastic people. Like one of them, Jonathan, my co-founder, very talented guy, absolutely brilliant. Another one is I actually probably shouldn't toss out any of the names, but they hired other people that just don't put words in people's mouths. They hired other people that were extremely talented and, you know, frankly, kind of bored by the job that they faced, like their day-to-day job at Apple. So effectively they automated themselves whenever possible out of a job and worked on side projects and did all sorts of random things. And one of the things that Jonathan happened to get pulled onto was preparing, this would be Leopard's keynote. The second Tiger keynote. It was preparing demonstrations for the second Tiger keynote. He actually wrote some of the demos that were used by Steve on stage. And because he was involved with that, you know, we, and as a part of the program office, we were always very heavily involved in WWDC preparation, demo prep, making sure everything's executed appropriately. We just got to know each other and work kind of closely together for like 2-3 weeks preparing for that WWDC demo. And then after the demo went off, this was back in the days when a bunch of the executives would saunter over to the W Hotel and enjoy the successful keynote presentation. Mm-hmm. And we basically went out and, you know, had a good time out on San Francisco that night and just got to know each other. Then for another period of time, he moved over to the program office team and basically was helping us out for probably 3 or 4 months. And of course, then on the same team, we worked very closely together. And then soon after that, he became a manager on the software update integration team. That's what it is, software update integration. And then migrated over to the mail team. So we've always kind of known each other through the different roles that we played at Apple. And during that entire time, we always tossed around the idea of like, you know, we should start a company. Yeah, startups are awesome. We should totally do something out on our own. And in particular, Jonathan, because he's always had a very entrepreneurial spirit. He started like his own comic book company back when he was in elementary school, drawing and selling comic books. And when he was in college, he wrote a program, which we still sell today, called HyperEdit. It's the tried and true HyperEdit. We've barely touched it, but it's still out there working well. And HyperEdit is, to my knowledge, the first Mac side-by-side code and WebKit preview application where you would type code into one pane. Excuse me. You type code into one pane and get an immediate live presentation of what you typed in on the web view next to it.
Can I make a suggestion?
Yeah, sure.
You may want to update this webpage.
Please tell me you're not looking at the HyperEdit webpage.
I am. I just clicked the HyperEdit.
don't.
That's, for those of you, that's awesome. Honestly, I've tried this. It's great. It's a good app. The webpage is hilarious.
It's a venerable app, and I could talk much more in detail about it at some point because we'd love to update it, but there's serious issues with updating it. All of it's sandbox related.
Yeah, let's get to that. Anyway, I didn't mean to be a dick, but that's funny not to point out.
Yeah, we have a very nice web page. Aside from
that. If only you had a tool to make nice web pages.
Ouch! Zing. So he's always had that entrepreneurial spirit. He wrote HyperEdit when he was in college, sold that as a shareware application, and that's actually what got him his job at Apple. And he's always wanted to, you know, Apple was for me as well. Apple was kind of like the stint of we'll do this for a year, 2 years maybe. And then go off and do something else. Like it's just kind of a jumping pad off to a future job, either in our own company, in some other company, whatever it happened to be. And that never really came to pass. Like I got wrapped up at Apple. I loved working there. I fantastic place to work. I loved my team. Really, really great people. Mm-hmm. I loved my responsibilities. I loved the purview I had over the operating system. It was an incredible role.
Can I ask why you left?
Oh, I'm getting there.
Okay.
Yeah, totally. So basically, the startup idea had always been fermenting with us, and we tossed around some ideas. Nothing really stuck. And after 6 years, to answer your question, Guy, it mm-hmm. 6 years on the same team and effectively the same role. Like my responsibilities have been dramatically increased over the years, but mm-hmm. It became just due to the nature of the organization at the time. It was obvious that there was not really much opportunity for me to move up. Mm-hmm. Yeah, really not to move up in the organization and take on additional management responsibilities. And likewise, there were not many opportunities coming from a program management role. It's very, very difficult to move into something else. Like mm-hmm. my coding skills had totally atrophied by that point. And it's hard to make the transition either into engineering management. I even interviewed with Galenci's, the evangelists, you know, work alongside like Jury, for example.
Yeah.
And, you know, what it came down to is I just didn't have the coding expertise necessary to make a leap into some other role in the company. Hmm. So it was kind of like I'd hit this wall of sorts, and I enjoyed what I was doing, but there was no obvious forward motion I could make. And Jonathan then approached me. This would probably be in September 2010. So I was kind of like at the peak of my frustration with not having a clear path forward. We were just now starting to wrap up Mountain Lion, I think it was. God, was it Lion or Mountain? It was Lion. Jesus. Yeah, Lion. Just starting to wrap up Lion. And my responsibilities were starting to taper down. And he's like, hey, so I got this idea. And you know, just kind of wanted to bounce it off him. Like, his idea was basically, in a nutshell, Flash Killer. Like, without a doubt, it was hype. It was producing an app to produce animated content for the web that didn't require Flash and was very easy to use, designer-friendly. And I'm like, yeah, you know, it's obvious. The writing was on the wall. Flash was dead at this point, but nobody had moved in to take that opportunity and produce a tool like Hype. I'm like, God, yeah, that's
exactly the right time to do it.
Yeah, it's a fucking brilliant idea. That's awesome. And kind of we kind of left it at like, oh, that's really good. And then a couple months later, I actually took a month off. This would be in November. I took a month off and went backpacking in Nepal, and that totally, as a result of taking a month off, like I had to divorce myself from like all responsibilities. Like I had to make sure that everything that I was, all my day-to-day tasks were farmed out to other people, and everyone else in the company knew that I was not going to be there if something urgent cropped up. It just wasn't going to be answered because you don't really have many opportunities to, you know, access a secure network when you're in the Kubu Valley in Nepal. So when I came back from that, it was like, well, shit, this is a great opportunity to do something else. And Jonathan suggested that we move forward with it and apply to Y Combinator, one of the startup accelerators here in the Valley. Mm-hmm. And I was like, you know what? Sure. If we get accepted by Y Combinator, if YC decides to fund us and we can be a part of that program, let's do it. Like I'll take the jump. There's no looking back. Cause honestly, YC was one of the programs that I wanted to do right after I graduated. Paul Graham had just announced YC, like months before I graduated, and you know, I didn't seize the opportunity. I didn't even try to go for it, but I was always like, hey, it's kind of a cool idea, you know, a chance to ferment an idea and try to grow it into a company and go on from there. And I figured like, hey, if I can actually do that, it's kind of like another life goal, just like getting into Apple. It's kind of another life goal checked off the list. I'll do it. And lo and behold, we pitched YC and got accepted into their winter 2011 class. And that's that. So it wasn't so much like I felt that I was disappointed with what I was doing at Apple. It was more like all of these external factors kind of came together and just it was time for a life change. 6 years, same job, something needed to happen. And the opportunity to start a company and more importantly, an engineering focused company gave me the chance to try new things that I'd never done before, like starting a company and doing all the, honestly, the tedious bullshit around managing the company and making sure we're in good graces with the government. But at the same time, get back into engineering and start freshening up my Objective-C skills and really just exercised muscles that hadn't been exercised in a long, long time. So it seemed like the right move to make. And it has certainly turned out to be the right move to make.
So what you ended up making is incredibly impressive.
Thanks.
No, seriously. And I say that as a guy that, you know, I think the first thing I said to you is fuck you.
So you're very...
So I'm being honest. I'm being honest. It is very much a flash killer, which is a very ambitious goal to strive for, especially with your first app and an indie app. Was that because of the YC funding that you felt like you could do something so ambitious because you had some backing?
No, it's because of Jonathan. It's totally because of Jonathan.
Okay.
Honestly, the guy is unbelievably talented, just incredibly productive. I mean, I hope he's not going to listen to this podcast because it's going to inflate his ego. But, you know, people say that there's like the 5Xers and the 10Xers, you know, the people that you hire onto a team and their productivity multiplier is 5X, 10X. He's 100X. Like it's incredible what he's able to put together in the span of time in which he's able to put it together. Like when it comes to development, I am basically holding onto the code base with both hands, trying not to be thrown loose as he just changes everything and adds incredible new features. And at the same time, like he's able to do a lot of the icon design and just jack of all trades. It's fantastic to be a part of, to be his partner, to have founded a company with him. So that I would say is a large part of it, is he is just a very skilled developer. And then some of it is, this was a very obvious continuation from HyperEdit. So there was actually a nice chunk of code that we were able to take. I mean, I wouldn't say it's hugely significant, but there are things, the key things like our source code editor that we use for JavaScript and HTML editing. Some of the hooks that we built into WebKit for live previews and things like that, that we're just able to pull over wholesale. And we're able to very quickly actually get a usable prototype in the span of just a couple of weeks.
That's interesting, because I would have thought that the canvas and the sort of the timeline would have been the major.
The timeline is and continues to be, you know, one of the bigger, trickier parts of the system.
Yeah.
For the canvas, a lot of that is really just kind of a simple hack of, I say simple, it's a lot of code, of having an invisible overlay window over the web view that captures all the input, forwards it as necessary. And, you know, frankly, once you make something content editable, WebKit does a lot of the work for allowing text editing. And if you're dragging something around the canvas, it's just simple DOM updates and I shouldn't say canvas if you draw something around the scene editor, because canvas is a very different connotation.
Sorry. HTML5. Yeah.
If you're dragging something around the scene editor, it's a lot of just simple DOM manipulations to update X and Y coordinates and width and height. And it's fairly straightforward, I guess, is what I'm getting at. The timeline, though, is that was one of the longer pulls in the 1.0 release, was getting that to a point where it was something that we felt would be usable by designers, like by our target market, which is somebody who's not versed in prior animation tools and not necessarily versed in coding.
Right.
That they can just like, they know Keynote, they know PowerPoint, they know Illustrator and Photoshop, and that's it. Like, we wanted something that they could approach and use. And that took a good bit of time to finally iron out. Like, that was probably the longest, without a doubt, the longest feature that we had to work on before we shipped 1.0.
Yeah, I bet that kind of stuff's not easy. It's kind of fashionable for Apple nerds to bash Flash, because Flash kind of sucks. But the idea isn't bad. Yeah, exactly. Well,
the original idea was good, because like I did Flash animation when it was like Macromedia still, and it worked great for timeline animation, keyframing, fantastic. I think it just grew to try to do more things than it was actually well designed to do.
Right. I mean, when we had Adam Saltzma on the show, who did Cannonball and a bunch of other games, hundreds, and whatever. Smart
great
guy,
interview, by the way. I really enjoyed that interview.
Oh, thanks. He's a very, very smart guy.
Yeah.
Yes, yes, he is.
Honestly, 99% of the show is that we get good guests.
I'm pulling down the average.
Yeah. This one stinks. But he did a lot of work in Flash, and he kind of respects it. And I think there's a lot of value in that sort of environment. And I think that you guys with Hype are trying to capture that.
Well, we very much are. Yes.
And I think it's a super noble and very interesting goal. Do you plan to add any kind of programmatic input, and how would that kind of fit in with everything? Because I know you have JavaScript hooks.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, we already do have programmatic input in a way, in the sense that it's our runtime is JavaScript, so you're perfectly willing and able to, or perfectly able to, execute arbitrary JavaScript.
Oh, you can do arbitrary stuff. I thought you had a few hooks for different things. I didn't realize that it was.
Yeah, so at least with 1.6, the last release before Hype 2 that just came out, we allowed and pretty much all the Hype 1 stuff.
I bought Hype 2, but I haven't checked it out yet. So maybe I'm
such
a
loser. It's been all of 24 hours.
Even I have used it, Guy.
Yeah. Funny thing is, I've been trying the betas, but I don't know. I haven't tried the JavaScript stuff.
Yeah, that's fine. So yeah, the hooks that we offer are mostly in the action system. So Hype presents a series of actions that can be run either in response to user events like mouse clicks and button presses. And on timeline events, we allow you to put actions actually on the timeline so you can execute at specific points in time. And then scene events. So like when a scene is loaded, when a scene is unloaded, when a timeline completes playback, all of those things can produce actions. There's actually with Hype 2, we have a very rich system of like touches and drags and swipes.
Keyboard events?
We do. It's okay. Basically key press, like key down, key up, key press. We hook into those. We don't allow you to.
You could full on make a game with this.
Oh, if you're ambitious enough, yeah, certainly. And we've seen some pretty ambitious people make nothing. You know, we're not talking cannibal style games here, but it's very much it's an open ended development system that we do de-emphasize a lot of the JavaScript programming because the focus is, and we have this all over our marketing. It's like make brilliant and stunning web animations without a single line of code. So we try to de-emphasize the coding aspect, but it's JavaScript. You can key presses. Actually, I was amazed. Stephen Decker, our engineer, like our full-time engineer, aside from me, Jonathan, produced a demo for Hype 2. Just a really simple demo of a flying saucer floating over a field of cows. And when you click on a cow, the flying saucer swoops over it. And it plays sound and lights up and zaps the cow off. And
that's great.
He coded up the entire thing so it'll track the number of cows on the field he didn't code up anything at all. He built this entire game. Very simple, yes, but a game where you can click on arbitrary cows. And when you get all the cows off the field, it presents a little victory sign just by using our timeline animation system and having like a timeline that sits there and advances forward when you happen to get another cow. And when he did that, it hit me that the timeline system, if we put just a little more effort into it, is basically a Turing complete system. it's a little tape of instructions that can go forward, go backwards, jump to locations. It kind of floored me at that point. And it's.
Yeah. I think that's what a lot of Flash developers really dig.
Yeah.
It's a great system.
Yeah, and it's kind of like AppleScript for a lot of people that are sort of more classically trained. In that, while it may be Turing complete, we can't wrap our heads around it. But that doesn't mean that other people can't. You know, so we look at it and be like, "What the hell? This is crazy! Like, why would I want to do this?" Meanwhile, somebody who's a tinkerer can just do incredible things with it. You know.
It's pretty impressive. I guess to get back to your question of whether or not we want to add more programmatic hooks and things like that, I think it's a future. I'd be lying if I said we didn't. I think there's a lot of opportunity there to continue evolving the web development process so that it's more accessible to people who don't necessarily have very rich JavaScript experience, but can begin piecing together either actions that are provided by other people, like people could encapsulate and share predefined actions and you could chain those together, or that they can at least kind of figure out simple JavaScript to accomplish the things that they need to do with the assistance of like our editor or sufficient tutorials and things like that.
So you would shy away from actual like textual code in favor of a sort of module system, maybe? Is it that fits into the timeline? Does I don't even know if I'm making sense there. I'm trying to.
Well, you're making sense to me. Whether or not you're making sense to everyone else is a whole different question.
I don't care about that.
I think, and this is totally speculation, like to be perfect here, I'm just thinking out loud here. Hype, as in hype itself right now, I think will always be focused on very designer-friendly interactions. So I feel like we're always going to kind of marginalize job, not marginalize, but reduce the need
emphasis on right.
Yeah, exactly. Reduce the emphasis on JavaScript and hype. Now, whether or not we introduce future products that are more JavaScript coding focused, or you know, like a Hype Pro that allows you has a very rich JavaScript editor, and you could build up widgets or sprites or modules that could be shared to other people. I mean, there's all things that we've talked about. And to be clear for those listeners, we don't have any current plans now for pursuing these, but it's obvious that there is a huge opportunity there that's, again, still being left open by Flash, because I think it would be fantastic to have something that is powerful enough for Cannibalt to be made, or other Flash games of that nature to be made.
Frankly, Adobe should have done this 5-8 years ago.
I totally agree. I mean, I totally agree. Glad they didn't, but I totally
agree. Oh, yeah. No, I'm glad you ate their lunch. So Hype 2.0 came out as we're recording this yesterday.
Correct. Yeah. August 20th.
How are you feeling, buddy?
Holy crap. Oh, man. Releases are so good. There's nothing like shipping software. It's such a good feeling. It's kind of touching on my experience at Apple. It blows me away how shipping an operating system, you know, with millions and millions of lines of code that goes out to hundreds of millions of people, tens of millions, I guess, in OS X's case, can feel as painful as shipping a single application, which thankfully is not millions and millions of lines of code, and only going out to tens of thousands of people. Like the amount of effort that goes into that and how stressful it is and how anxious you get, it's about equal. Like it's still
the worked on projects big and small, and the stress is the same.
Yeah. It blows my, like I totally figured when we shipped Hype 1 that it'd be like, oh God, yeah, I've shipped operating systems. I can handle this. No, God, no. It was even more stressful because it's the first version of something that I like had a direct role in making. Yeah. Like, it's all on the line. But once it's out there, God, it feels so good. Yeah. It's been really good to have it out there. Customer feedback has been very positive. People are excited about some of the new features that we've added. And it's more importantly, I think it's finally, not only do you get the endorphin rush of having shipped something, which is just feel good, like you want to hold on to that. But it means you can finally start looking forward to the future again. Like you're not dealing with the minute details of the now.
Yes.
You're able to start thinking like, okay, let's step back. Let's evaluate the landscape. Let's deal with all the customer input that we're getting. And let's start thinking about what we can do next and how to move Hype forward, how to move the company forward, how to move ourselves forward. It's such a good feeling.
Yeah.
And you can go on multiple hour-long podcasts with friends and not feel guilty.
Yeah, this is going long, but it's awesome. I'm having a great time. And I don't care to stop. I totally agree. So when was 2.0 done? Was it recently, or did you have to stress for that? Did you have a deadline? Like, how do you guys manage yourselves internally? And I, you know, I'll compare that to how Parrish and I do stuff at A&D.
So 2.0 has been an interesting release in that it's probably, I guess I would compare it to like a band sophomore album where the first hit or the first release was a hit and you're like, oh God, this is amazing. But now we've got to top that. Shit. What are we going to do? And you start with very simple plans, and then it grows and accumulates and evolves from there. And hell, I've seen this even happen again with OS X. It's just like you start with simple plans and they just snowball.
It's fascinating how much psychology plays into that too.
Oh, it really does. Cause
like, it's not necessarily the market. It's just like, well, no, we have to do better than X because that's what we expect.
Exactly. And as a result, like we really, I would say probably had something we could ship as a 2.0, like a legitimate 2.0, March-ish.
Yeah.
January, February, March. Yeah, March-ish, somewhere around there, like the beginning of this year. But there were still other things that we wanted to add in that we felt would really make this a true 2.0. And then, of course, we had those things and we're like, well, shit, now this feels old too. Like, we've got to do something else and tack that on. And, like, I don't want to say, like, again, if customers are listening, like, we're not just arbitrarily pulling this stuff together out of our hat, but it's just this process of feeling out the product and trying to, I guess it's that jazz thing again. It's like improvising and figuring out what needs to happen next. And you're like, well, this isn't quite what we want it to be. We could do this a little bit better. We could add that. We could go here.
Yeah. Well, I mean, once you hang the new curtains, the couch looks like shit. And then
that's a great analogy.
You got to go buy a new couch, you know?
Yeah. And I think we finally settled on the full set of features that we really definitively wanted in 2.0. May or June. So it's been, we've had the final full set of features on a list since then. We've basically been finished with engineering, probably June, late June. And then it was a lot of just bug fixing and beta testing. And then a lot over the past couple of weeks of all of the other stuff, because we're just a 4-man shop. We don't have AppleCare. We don't have marketing and communications. We don't have, you know, teams of people to handle all this, of writing documentation and updating the website and producing feature videos and the welcome videos and the what's new videos and all the stuff that goes involved with that. So that's what the past couple of weeks have been. It's just the infrastructure around the release. So Hype itself has been reviewed and approved. I think 2 or 3 weeks ago. It's been a while in the grand scheme of things, but getting all the ducks in a row for a successful release that we can be proud of has been a lot of work, it always is.
So much work for that. And actually Chris and I do a bad job of that.
I'll give full credit to Jonathan on motivating us to do, to go to the links that we go to for producing documentation and the welcome videos and the feature videos and the what's new videos, all of that. Like, he's a very product oriented, very product focused guy. And that's frankly one of his biggest strengths.
It's
about
understanding
how it fits into the ecosystem and what's necessary for it to be not just a good app, but a good product.
Yeah. No, you guys really communicate the product well. I mean, the intro video is great. I think it's you narrating it, actually.
It is.
Good job.
My official voiceover presence,
right. And it's like a minute long, which is great. It's perfect time. And you know what? The What's New video is about, 9 minutes long.
Something like that, yeah.
And it actually explains the product. So I love the attention to detail that you guys put into this. And I appreciate it because we're still trying to get our legs under us for,
it's
getting our story together for napkins. So
I'm just grateful that we now have Steven, our full-time engineer, to handle engineering while Jonathan and I are distracted by all the other things that are going on. Mm-hmm. Like, he's able to still fix and investigate bugs and, kind of go off and start working on whatever emergency updates may need to happen while we're sitting here working on documentation. And Daniel Morgan is our kind of our customer liaison documentation lead. And he's been fantastic in really fleshing out all the documentation, dealing with all the customer support when Jonathan and I again are distracted, not able to handle it as best we can. Mm-hmm. And then he's been really good about reaching out and doing webcasts to help customers answer questions and things like that. It's been like having that additional, those just two people have been invaluable. Like, it's awesome to have them on board, and they're people that, you can hand things off to. And when they come back, it's going to be something that you can be like, yes, okay, just, kind of dot that I and cross that T and, maybe change the color of this over here, and sweet, we're reasonably good to go.
So Tumult is what, 3 years old?
2.5. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were founded in December 2010.
And you hired, so you've grown, you've doubled in size.
Yeah, we've doubled in size.
Was that difficult? Was it hard to find people?
Oh, God, it's always impossible to find people. Yeah. Hiring is a nightmare. So,
that a hard decision to make? Like, some people are kind of precious about, like, well, we need an exact cultural fit. And that's kind of difficult because when you're two people, you add a third, things are going to change, right?
Yeah, like, culture changes dramatically regardless of what you do. Yeah. For cultural fit, I'm honestly not terribly concerned about that. Mm-hmm. I figure, from my perspective, culture is one of those things, improvisation. It's one of those things that has to change. Yep. And if it's not changing, people get bored, people get angry, people get frustrated. let it evolve, let it happen. Always keep an eye on it. Like, always make sure it's a healthy, vibrant culture. Yeah. But
don't degrade into being stupid. Just
don't worry about like, oh, we need bros to pop collars and to use the stereotype. Like, the startup culture is something that people worry about far too much. Right. Find intelligent, competent people that are easy to work with, and you know, keep it as diverse as possible. But we're kind of failing in that regard ourselves. But culture for me is a secondary concern to first identifying possible talent. Yeah. In the Valley right now, it's a nightmare. It's just a nightmare. Engineers are incredibly expensive, and we can thank startups like other Y Combinator companies, and Facebook and Google, and everyone just inflating the salaries of engineers. And to say nothing for all the startups that are out there, there's just an immense amount of demand placed on engineering talent. And as a second and third order function, that places an immense amount of demand on designers and people who can write good documentation and customer service and support and everyone else. Like, it's a very talent tapped area right now.
Do you think you benefit from being in the Valley, or do you suffer from it?
That's a really good question. That's a really good question. I'm not sure I have a right answer for that. I enjoy being in the Valley. I frankly am not terribly bothered by the startup mentality that's out here.
You can ignore it for the most part.
Yeah, I guess it goes back to the gold iPhone. If I don't associate with those people, if I don't give them any mind, then it's not my problem. Yeah, right. It's whatever. Now, that said, they do they cause my rent to go through the roof and cause other issues like that. But for the most part, it doesn't bother me. Being in close proximity to Apple, I think, has been very nice just for being able to meet up with the people that I know at Apple and pick people's brains and just happenstance that you run into.
Yeah. I mean, I'm down there twice a year, and I love my time there, and I meet and I hang out with great people, and it's totally invaluable to me.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I'm not sure that – I don't know. Running a business there seems like it could get costly pretty quick.
Well, can I just say you have it – well, actually, where are you guys based? Are you an American company or a Canadian company?
Tricky Dicky style. We're actually incorporated in Washington State. So Seattle. Okay. Yeah. And that was an intentional choice because we thought that dealing with Apple – would be easier if you were an American company.
Interesting.
Just because it cuts down on
possible
weirdness that may happen at some point, you know? So
The reason why I bring that up is I have friends who have started a couple companies, one in Toronto, and I think two in Toronto now. Canadian companies have it so easy. Healthcare. You guys have healthcare for everyone. Huge.
Well, I mean, I have healthcare outside of my company. It's just
Medical care and healthcare is up to you.
Sure.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay.
But I mean, you know, we have human rights here, so.
Yeah, you do. That's depressing.
But yeah, so that must be hard for you guys. I mean, so you hire a couple people. I mean that. I don't know. It seems to me that running a company in the Valley is a tricky proposition.
I'd say it's a tricky proposition anywhere. And that's why I don't have a good answer for your question, because my only experience is running companies in the Valley. So I don't have, other stateside experience or other international experience. Right. There are things that are a pain. California's just frustrating to deal with. San Francisco is even more frustrating to deal with. But at the same time, it's a good place to work. It's a fun city. It's a fun area. I love just the entire California region.
Yeah.
So given the trade-offs, I think we're happy being here. But I can't definitively say yes or no one way because I have such limited experience.
Yeah. No, I was just curious.
And when it comes to hiring, the bigger challenge is, again, just finding people. And honestly, being comfortable in ourselves and in the company to know that we can take somebody on and not put their livelihood or the company at a risk.
And that's interesting is all of the small business people that I know that have ever had to hire their first hire, what they're most concerned about is like am I going to be able to pay this guy or am I going to screw up his life?
Yeah.
Well, like it's such, I love that. It's such a human thing. It's, that's not a business decision. It's like, that's just not wanting to be a dick. Do you know what I mean?
That's true. Yeah.
Which is fascinating, but all of the, to a person, every small business owner that I've ever spoken to has worried about that.
Well, from my perspective, there's two separate concerns. One is the business concern of needing to fill a role.
Right.
And that is a very pragmatic decision of saying, well, crap, we're swamped in support, or we are so strapped on engineering, or we need a designer to make beautiful graphics and help improve application design and behavior. That's a very pragmatic business thing. And that is separate and related to, but independent from hiring a person. And hiring the person is a very personal thing. That's where you have to know
that
by hiring somebody
right?
on, you're becoming responsible in many ways for that person, and not like in a paternal sense, but in a livelihood sense.
Yeah.
You've got to shape them. You've got to educate them. You've got to support them. You've got to have all the infrastructure in place to make sure that they are successful and that they're able to grow as people.
Right. And, I mean, you want to be able to have a coffee and be like, how are the kids?
Yeah.
And not know that like, well, I'm not going to pay you next week.
Exactly. Like,
yeah. So it was difficult recruiting these people. Why? Was it the technical prowess? Was it like finding people that you could get along with?
Really, it was on a – okay. So first we hired Daniel, our the documentation customer support mastermind. And
great,
for him
– a great position to hire first, by the way.
Oh, it requisite position for us to hire first, honestly.
Yeah. So what we're doing. Yeah.
Pipe one shipped, and Jonathan and I have been very aggressive – some of this might come from our experience at Apple, but we've been very aggressive about making sure that we can always capture customer information and build relationship with customers. We offer the email signup form numerous times. There's two different areas in the application where you can send us feedback directly from the application. We put email addresses everywhere. All the emails that we send out have like direct replies that go to people, that go to a working address, not to a do not reply. Like every time we interact with the customer, we try to make sure that there's some aspect of the relationship that we're building up there. And that's great because we're building relationships with our users, with the people that allow us to do what we want to do. It's bad because they give us a lot of feedback. And the Hype One release was...
No, it's not bad because they give you a lot of feedback. It's, it's problematic in that it takes time.
Correct. That is, that's the better way to phrase it.
Yes.
You are totally correct.
Yeah. Trying to say.
And the Hype One release was successful enough that we just got inundated with feedback. And it was probably three and a half months of nothing but Jonathan and I day in and day out dealing with customer feedback, replying to emails, replying to tweets, replying to Facebook posts. And
in a way, that's great, right? I mean, you're.
Oh, no complaint. Well, I do have complaints, but it's a great problem to have.
Yes, exactly.
The downside is, development on Hype entirely stalled at that point. Like we fixed bugs, we pushed out bug fixes and a couple of minor features here and there.
Yeah.
But so we couldn't tackle anything big.
Right. You know, so there's only so many hours in the day. It's
oh God, yeah. And after dealing with customers, after working with customers, I don't want to say this is a problem. Yeah. After working with customers.
You know what? I like your tone of phrase there. You changed it from dealing with customers to working with customers.
But and
I
think
I like working with customers a lot better. Dealing seems like I'm kind of trying to be dismissive of this, and I want.
And that's why I changed it. It's like I really want to emphasize, like, I appreciate, I savor this relationship, I treasure this relationship, but it's very time consuming. And after spending, 8, 10, 12 hours working with customers, there's no time, there's no mental energy left.
Right.
To
I mean,
work on the product.
Yes, because in a certain way, it's. If you have a conversation with each individual customer, you're serving your customer base poorly.
Yeah.
In a way, you're serving them individually well, in that you're dedicating your time to discuss things with them. But in the grand sense, you're not moving the product forward.
Exactly.
So you're not serving them well in the functional sense.
Correct. Yeah. And that's why hiring Daniel for customer support was just like, we need to do this. Like, we must do this.
Yeah.
And, you know, unfortunately for us, Hype is not a simple application.
No.
The array of questions that we get range from, how do I add images to a scene, all the way to I have this content management system that I need to integrate the exported Hype content into, all the way to I have custom JavaScript libraries that I've tried to integrate in this manner, and I'm seeing this output when I, you know, click this button over here. Can you help me out? So it's all the
honestly, I would have considered an app like this and dismissed it as being too like resource intensive in terms of support.
it can be sort of like
we talked about another app. We had lunch at one point with Chris. And that just sounded like.
Oh yes, that one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Would have been a huge yes.
Yes. You know what I mean? It's like, okay, we could do this, but that's just asking for trouble, you know?
Oh, God. So especially not with the ecosystem that you'd be playing in. Oh, man.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I love that we're just having a very private conversation, very publicly right now.
Yes. Apologies.
Yeah.
So hiring Daniel was an absolute important move that we needed to make, but finding somebody who had that, who was able to run that gamut is... and still be personable, still present themselves well to customers, and still be polite and honor the customer is a very difficult task. And thankfully, what happened is, so by having gone through Y Combinator, we're now a part of the Y Combinator founder group, which is an email list that all the founders, all the past founders that are a part of, and current founders as well. And, you know, every day, probably 10, 15 messages come across from people announcing new products or requesting support from some, you know, hey, I've hit this problem. Can you help us out? Or like trying to get introductions to like, hey, we need VP of Amazon. Can you get us an introduction? It's an incredibly powerful resource to have. Right. And what happened is somebody said basically, you know, we brought Daniel on board for the customers that just didn't really show up. And we love what he's done. He's been fantastic for us. We hope that he can find a job with some other company. We saw this email come across and we're like, we're going for it. Invited him out and met up with him. You know, I think we grabbed coffee or something like that. And then he worked with us for a couple of days. So we could just feel what it was like to work together and get a feel for how he approached problems. He could see how we worked together. And things just clicked. So we, you know, brought him on board. It's been such a load off of us. He's invaluable. And Steven was honestly kind of that same role where we wanted to be very – actually, I should say Steven is always he had contracted with us for a couple of months, maybe almost a year before we actually brought him on board because he used to work for Jonathan at Apple on the mail team.
Okay. He does development, by the way.
Yeah, he's a full-time engineer. He helps out with support when stuff comes across. And like yesterday with the Hype 2 launch, we were all full-time support, of course.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
But we brought him on board as an engineer. And it was, again, that same kind of decision of like, you know, where things just aren't moving fast enough for the product. We want to tackle these features. And Steven's been great as an engineer, but he's working remotely. Been great as a contractor, but he's working remotely. We just got to convince him to come back to San Francisco because he moved over to Michigan to be closer to his family. And we just decided we had to convince him to come back to San Francisco and bring him on as a full-time engineer. And thankfully he went for it. But that was another case of having connections and having the opportunity to work with him, granted remotely, but as a contractor over a period of time, we got to know how he works and the kind of code he produced. And Jonathan, of course, worked with him at Apple for, I think, a year or so.
Yeah. So there's so very close familiarity with how they,
Exactly. That's so important.
How do you feel about working remote? I work remote for all of my clients. I can understand why people want an office. No, I don't mean that in a bad way. I'm just, you know, I get it. I understand it both ways. It seems like you have made a conscious choice to encourage people to come to the office.
That is very much the case, yes. Part of the culture that we want to help foster is one of a vibrant office. You know, kind of the mental image that we have for Tumult down the line is one of a bustling office space full of happy, hard workers that we can all just relate to and get along with and enjoy each other's company and frankly, feed off of each other's company, you know, foster those ideas, those kind of chaotic interactions that happen when you're working day in and day out with somebody.
Yeah. The organic. Just to tie it into the gestalt of your discussion.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's not to denigrate remote people working remotely at all. It's just right now when we're really first defining this culture, we want to have an emphasis on people being local. I guess it goes back to culture, something that you let evolve, but you have to kind of guide it and help shape it. That's something we made a very conscious decision on. It's like right now we want to focus on just building up a local team. And at the, you know, at some point in the future, remote is could happen. And I don't want to ever rule something out.
But. Okay. So you're not like philosophically opposed to the idea of working remotely?
No, not at all. I will say that by having made the conscious decision to foster a local office, that does probably predispose us to being mostly local in the future. Mm-hmm. Just because all the communication channels that come about are going to expect that locality and that constant local presence communication.
Right.
Versus somebody like some company like GitHub, where by being a remote company from the start, their entire culture has fostered these communication vectors that inherently expect distributed, possibly disconnected and asynchronous communication. Like right. They had to build up the culture like that.
Right. Well, maybe it's like that too.
Yeah. And I think that's
conversely, like, you know, Omni Group and Panic are very much like you guys.
Yeah.
Office-based, so you know?
I would never rule it out, but I would say that by having made that conscious decision, we probably...
you kind of set the course, right?
Like exactly. And I think it's a decision every company has to make. So that's just kind of the way that goes.
Did you fret over it, or is it just like obvious? Like, yeah, we're going to get some office space and move in.
I'd say from coming from Apple, which is a very local company itself, it was kind of a no-brainer. Like, frankly, a lot of the things that we do at Tumult are directly derived from our experiences at Apple.
Yeah, everybody I've worked with that's come from Apple has been like, you know what? This is what we did at Apple.
So, it worked for them.
Yeah.
No, it's very true. And that's, I think it's been a very important part of the culture that we've had, that we've tried to help foster. It's like the radar mentality of always tracking things in a bug reporter.
Oh, yeah.
Trying to get constant feedback from customers, being local. Just the presence that we present ourselves with, we very much take pattern off of Apple.
Yeah. Which you should. Well, quote unquote should. I mean, it's an understandable approach that, you know, why wouldn't you? It's successful. It works. It's a, you know.
And frankly, I think it's being honest to how we learn. You know, it's, I guess, kind of like going to University of Colorado and becoming a deep sea and operating systems oriented guy and being loving those, just absolutely loving those is really kind of, I picked that up largely because I was surrounded by it all the time and endued with it at CU. Likewise, to throw off the lessons that I learned at Apple would be, you know, really disingenuous. Like why did I spend the 6 years really kind of working my ass off and trying to do my best in that framework to just then discard that framework when it is demonstrably successful?
Exactly.
Take the lessons I've learned and play with them. So yeah, it's been really good so far. That just the four of us, and we would love to hire. If anyone's out there, we would love to hire a full time designer.
You're expanding a designer.
We would love to expand. It's been very difficult to find people. Basically, what we want to build out next, or the direction I should say that we want to go next, is further expanding our documentation, our tutorials, and our sample projects. And as I'm an engineer, I cannot draw worth a damn. I'm not creative in the least. Like, there's not a creative bone in my body. And in order to, okay.
Thank you.
Bad way to phrase
Let's
it.
Move on. And
we'll ignore that statement. I cannot produce beautiful looking documents. we'll go that route.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much the case for, well, I shouldn't say Jonathan, because he can actually do really good work. And Steven's fairly good at drawing and designing stuff himself.
So but we want to have somebody. You're the least useful person at the company.
Oh, God. It's so true. It's so true.
Can you put somebody else on the line?
He does great voiceovers.
There we go. That's the value that I bring to the company.
The baritone.
What we want to do is start building out beautiful documents that look professional, something like Apple would produce, for example. Yep. And
to do so, you require some design talent and some creativity.
Make things that don't look like crap and are actually, each document is then unique and outstanding. You know who does this well? And I don't know how they do it. I don't know if they contract out. Is Pixelmator. If you haven't, you should take a look at Pixelmator's tutorial videos. They're phenomenal. They are outstandingly well done. And I'm very jealous and envious of them. But we want somebody who can help take us to that next level in terms of design, both with producing documents and ideally with the application itself, both kind of refreshing the look and with things, making them better, more intuitive behaviors. And I guess the final thing is having somebody who really, honestly, truly, day in and day out, uses the app.
Right.
You know, as an engineer, somebody working on it, I do the basic things necessary to test the feature that I'm working on and make sure that no regressions are introduced, which is very far removed from actually using it, like legitimately using it in a workflow with other different applications and, you know, using tablets and Wacom devices and things like that.
Yeah.
It would be invaluable to have somebody who does that all day long.
Yeah,
it's so totally that we can kind of give them like, hey, test out this feature. Are we on the right path here, or are we just – we're just totally insane.
Right. I mean, when I was working on games, I'd, you know, write something, load the game, test out that what I'd just done actually works.
Yeah.
I playing the game? That doesn't happen that much. You know, like you don't actually play the game that much. So you need somebody that's actually playing the game or testing the app and running through it day to day.
Yep.
Which is why 1.0 releases are such a weird thing.
Oh, they really are.
Because you throw it out in there in the world, and then you hear, you know, you hear back from users, and you're like, oh yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
Kind of dumb. Should have done that. You're right. You guys ship a premium app on the Mac App Store.
Yes. We are.
And when we, you know, Chris and I, indeed, do the same thing ish. We're a little cheaper, but, and we're not as fancy as you guys. No, we're not. Like our app is less complicated than yours. Why do you do that? Like, why didn't you chase iOS? I know you've got a lot of Mac OS X experience, and I know that, you know,
because we're masochists.
Well, I think that the Mac is the right platform for this app. And I think that you, like us, sort of came at a problem and you just decided that, like, well, this is the best way to solve it.
Yeah.
Right, so now.
Jonathan's experience where, again, making creative apps, he produced HyperEdit back in college. And he's always, even at Apple, he'd make things that helped other people do their jobs, be it analysis tools or tiny little applications that he wrote to help his own life. And for me, frankly, I enjoy working on things that are foundational. I like enabling other things to happen. I think that's one of the reasons why I like operating systems so much is because, you know, aside from like compilers, that's about as low as you can go. Like everything you do helps other people. Yep. It either helps
honestly,
them do the job or create other things. And I love that.
The thing I loved most about games was setting up systems so that designers and artists could do interesting stuff. I loved coming in the morning and having an artist just have written some kind of weird shader that just blew my mind.
Yeah, it's an incredibly rewarding experience.
Yeah.
Like, I love being floored by the documents our users send us where, you know, you open it up and you're like, oh, this is going to be another one of those standard. Oh, holy shit. What did they do?
How did you even
You spend like 30 minutes like dissecting the document and figuring out like all the tricks that they played. And like, oh, wow, you can compose those things together. And wow, why didn't I think of that? So I think that shared appreciation of helping others create things is really what led us to go down the path of producing a tool like Hype. And then Jonathan's experience with WebKit and with web technologies in general is what kind of focused us in on the HTML5 space. So it's like pairing up his passion of web and our mutual passions of creative tools, things that enable and empower other people. Just distilled out, Hype is as we know it.
But why the Mac? Why not, you know?
Oh, God, come on. I can't even imagine doing something like Hype on the iPad.
I know.
No, that's a lie. I really can, and no, I would love.
I mean, because Coda kind of does, Coda Light.
Diet so Coda. The interesting thing is Coda Light is actually it's a good editing tool, but it's not a good creative tool. Honestly, I would love to be on the iPad. I desperately, desperately want to have something on the iPad. I want to have a creative app that is used on the iPad. Mm-hmm. The problem is...
With 2.0, in fairness, you do have Hype Reflect?
Hype Reflect, yeah. It's a companion app You know, honestly, the similar apps on the market kind of escaped me, but it's a little app for eliminating all of the pain of previewing your hype documents on iOS devices.
Yeah.
And in that sense, it's a very simple app.
Yeah.
There's nothing creative about it. It's more about enabling you to streamline your process and your workflow.
Yeah. I thought it was a great idea and a nice little, little cherry on top of the 2.0.
Oh, God. It's a great cherry. I love it. It's fantastic just for testing out documents that I'm working on or helping customers with their own documents. Like instead of having to set up a local server and type in the URL in Safari on iOS, now it's just click a button on in Hype for the Mac and it immediately appears in HyperFlect on the iOS. And I can we have a mirror mode that you can flip to where you can edit as you're editing the document live on the Mac, all of your changes appear instantly on the iOS device. So you can have an iPad sitting next to your iMac. And as you're rearranging content, changing colors, adding text, you see exactly how it looks on the iPad in real time, which is phenomenal for dealing with the color differences and the metrics differences between Safari on iOS and Safari on the Mac. I mean, they're minor, but they definitely exist, especially with colors.
Yeah.
So I think that'll be very important.
Don't get me started on colors. Mm.
That's right. I remember seeing some Twitter conversations with you.
Yeah.
We'll back away from that topic.
Yeah. 2.5 hours in. You know what? I think you've got two shows. we're gonna have to split this up.
We're going to have to Gelfman it.
Yeah, we're going to Gelfman the shit out of this. Mac App Store and sandboxing.
So
let's go for show number three right now.
Are you just tossing those grenades out there and seeing
what's pretty what much? Happens? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you just run with stuff. So,
oh yeah, totally.
Do you want me to formulate a question or do you just want keywords?
No, I like the keyword topic. Let's play a word association game. Sandboxing pain. So honestly, yeah. Targeting the Mac, that's the only way that we could ever get what we wanted to be a reality. And I agree.
I don't think you could have done this on iOS because the nature of the problem to be solved requires a lot of integrating various files.
That's just the first order problem is getting content into iOS.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which is yet to be solved, unfortunately. And then there's the other problems of making minute changes, like a tap touch interface. Is it good for pixel aligning elements or shifting things by one pixel without zooming in and zooming out and zooming in and zooming out?
Right.
It's something we want to tackle, but the problems there are so myriad that we just we'll do that later. It's something that I want to see happen at some point in some way.
Yeah.
We'll see.
I think it's fair to say that while we're both fans of iOS, the problems that your app and our app hopes to solve are best addressed on the Mac.
Yes, I very much agree on that. Yeah, totally. Yeah. And I guess to touch the Mac App Store grenade that you lobbed out there, and sandboxing as well. That's those things have really made it difficult to have. Well, let me think about this. I wouldn't say difficult. They've dramatically changed the landscape that we face as application developers, particularly as application developers making, quote, premium apps on the App Store. On one hand, the App Store is a hits-based store. You get an app out there, it's an explosive hit, you move on to the next one, it's a hopefully explosive hit, you move on to the next one.
Yeah. I really think it's a pop software is how I like to think about it. You know?
And unfortunately, apps like yours and mine aren't pop software.
No.
We legitimately want to keep this going. We're very proud of Hype. We're excited for the future. We have so many things that we want to tackle. And it's unfortunate we are going against the grain of the App Store because the App Store is a world-changing distribution vector. It removes so much friction and it allows for so much commerce that would not have been possible and was not possible earlier. We couldn't drop the App Store, straight up. We could not drop the App Store. We do too many sales on the App Store and it's too convenient for our customers. It's a reality that we have to face.
Yeah. I mean, we only sell on the App Store.
Yeah.
For various reasons, but
honestly, I would love to be App Store only. I would absolutely love to be App Store only, but the limitations, there's no bulk sales discounts. There's no education discounts. yeah. we can't do promotional coupon codes ad hoc. It's only the 50 promo codes that's either free or not free.
Right. I mean, without so actually restricted. Announcing anything, we're going to not be App Store only within a little while. Because we want to do site licenses and we want to do, you know.
I think the reality of being a Mac app today requires to being a long-standing supported Mac app today, not a hits-based game or something like that, absolutely requires that you be on both the Mac App Store and your own distribution vector.
Yeah. Which is a shame, because ideally it would just be Mac App Store, right?
Oh, God, yes. I have ranted to so many people at Apple that it needs to be. These restrictions need to be addressed. And I can't comment on the things that they've told me, but I'm not holding my breath. and it's a shame because it is fantastic. And it would be nice not to have to deal with two licensing schemes, not to deal with customer confusion about where they downloaded Hype from and where the licensing keys are and all the stuff that goes along with that.
Yeah. I mean, to me, that's the worst thing. Customer conversion confusion. That stinks. I don't want anybody to.
Especially when it's something that's forced out of our hand. This isn't a decision that we act. Well, I guess it is. But to meet the realities of the market, we had to do this. Mm-hmm. And as a result, because we had to do this, there's increased customer confusion. It's just, it makes me cringe.
Explaining to a customer that's like, well, it's just the way it is like, that stinks.
Hype 2 has been a fantastic launch, but it's been very, very difficult to see the emails that we've gotten from customers with legitimate concerns about how we handled our upgrade scheme. And because the App Store doesn't allow
you're at half price right now. It
doesn't allow for paid upgrades.
Yeah.
Our solution was basically the same solution that Panic took, where we're offering Hype at a very significant 50% off discount. Hype 2, I should say. It's a new app. We're offering it. Well, that's the first problem. Hype 2 is a separate app from Hype.
Right.
So all of our customers are now lost on one app and have to be pulled over to another app.
It's crazy.
It drives me insane. So first problem is that. Second problem is because there's no upgrade discount, because they are separate apps, it's either we penalize all of our past customers and have them pay the full price, or we penalize all of our customers who buy it on the Mac App Store and have them pay a full price and have some complicated upgrade process on our own store for people who bought it on the Mac App Store to transition over to our own store and get a discounted upgrade price, which
feels like a dick move, right?
It feels like, one, it's a dick move because you're obviously forcing them away from the venue that they wanted the app in the first place. And two, it's a complicated process. It's not like a simple... Either we have to produce an app, a separate app, a utility app to help them along with this and do the verification automatically for them, which is time consuming and error prone on our side. Or we give them a set of series of complicated steps of send us your iTunes receipt and we'll go back and give you the discount. And it's just not a good experience. Yeah. Or we do what we settled on, which is just cut the price 50% or, significant amount for all customers everywhere, regardless of where they purchase it. And tell the past customers that they should really take advantage of this opportunity now while it lasts. And it's going to go away in the future. That's just the reality that we face.
Yeah.
And, for the most part, the vast, vast, vast majority of our customers, it's not been an issue. And some of them have been very thankful about the discount that they've been offered. And we've gotten emails to that account. But there have been a vocal minority that are, honestly, legitimately angry about the fact that they're being treated the same as new customers, despite the fact that they vested their trust in us by buying the first version of Hype. Yeah. I could go on for hours on more hours about why it's strange that software has this mentality of free upgrades or discounted upgrades.
That is a whole nother show.
I really can't explain it. It's like somebody buys Battlefield 2, the game.
I know.
They don't expect a free version of Battlefield 3, nor do they expect a discounted version of Battlefield 3. But when it comes to software, but non-game software.
Don't even get me started.
I can't.
I wonder if that's a legacy issue, though, and kids growing up on iOS today will never even think about upgrade software the way we do.
Maybe. I very much heard that. It's just a very interesting reality that we face, and I can't change it. That is the reality that
There's something weird there. There's a weird expectation. It's
legacy expectation.
Yeah, maybe legacy. Well, I mean, eventually it'll be legacy.
Hopefully we're going to stop doing that. Yeah. The app store is
If we all stop doing it, then guess what? You know, like sooner or later.
But it's unfortunately soured us in the eyes of some of our customers, which
I know, which is the worst.
I take that personally because we try so hard to do our best by our users. Like they are everything to us. And when some user emails us and is like, "You've totally destroyed my trust in you." I take that personally because I believe in the company. I believe in the product. I believe in our users. I want to do best by them. And frankly, the decision that we made, I honestly, truly, really believe is the best decision we can make for our customers. It just sucks. And it's because of the App Store.
You can't. Yeah. And what are you going to do? Like write like 500 words. Like a 500-word essay explaining it to people. It's like, it doesn't matter what you explain to them. It's like, I can't, you know.
I just say, I apologize for it. And if they're particularly angry, like maybe I'll offer them a even more significant discount or, just dealing with a case-by-case basis. It's just do whatever you can to try to remedy that situation. But it's such a bad place to be in. So, I mean, right there, you've got like, it's a hits based store that, really encourages low prices. The lack of an upgrade venue further reinforces that hits based nature and makes it hard to continually support an app like ours.
Yep.
And then you wrap sandboxing into the mix and the App Store is just, it's a very frustrating, tricky place to be at times. Cause
I bet. So what permissions do you ask for in Hype? I mean, go ahead.
Yeah, we ask for – I should probably just pull up the provisioning profile, but I'll wing it. Ask for net access. We ask for address book access. We ask for
– net in and out access or
– oh, yeah, because it's a web view. So if you have a YouTube video that you want to show in Hype, we got to load that YouTube video. And for out, is there in and out? I think it's
Reflect probably needs out.
Oh, Reflect certainly needs out, yeah. But isn't it just networking, period? Is there an in and out?
I thought there was.
Yeah. There might be. So we certainly ask for networking both ways. We ask for address books so that we can pre-populate the feedback fields.
Is that dialogue box that pops up?
I despise that box. But it's good. I understand why it's there.
I know. But that's...
Cotton, what else do we ask for? We have... some other things like that. User granted file system access, because that's actually a provision.
Right.
And I'm just pulling up Xcode now. those are the key. Okay, so incoming outgoing connections, app sandboxing, and address book access. And then we ask for read access to all their media document or media folders. Mm-hmm. And user selected read write file access. So we ask for a lot.
You're pretty much checking all the boxes in that one.
I mean, thankfully we don't need printing, we don't need microphone and camera, but it's a lot. And then with 10.7, the bugs that we hit on 10.7, there's so many issues that we still run into with all those file system bookmark pain points that I could swear.
You know what? Let's be clear. The guys that work on this, very smart people.
Oh, brilliant.
I know that you and I know that, but
that's a very fair point.
On the radio. Very smart people. And they actually care and they will ask you what's screwed up and they will try to fix it.
Yes, very much so. That is a very, very good thing.
They are not blind to the problems. On the other hand, trying to retrofit an Eros style permission system on top of something like OS X is not an easy task.
I mean, you're basically trying to seatbelt the lion into the car. It's going to cut you in some way. Like you're just not getting out of there without some vicious wound.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the ramifications of sandboxing are rough on outside developers and even internal developers.
Well,
because I've seen them skirt the system a few times. I don't think it's a bad idea, and the people working on it aren't assholes. It's a good way to go. It's just a rough road to walk down.
I totally agree with that. I think it's very important for the future of the system, and especially for customer trust in the future of the system. Mm-hmm. I think it's a very, it must be done in concert with other security mechanisms like developer ID signing and, and other hardening that's happening across the system. Otherwise it's just laughably insecure. And the people that are working on it are very smart, very talented. I'm good friends with a couple of them. Very good friends with a couple of them. Yeah. At least when they're not screwing me over. I think it will be less painful in the future. But right now, it's the transition process is miserable. It's rough. And part of the problem, to be forthright and entirely honest about this, is Apple has screwed up, like, unforgivably by not sandboxing their own apps.
Yep.
That is the key problem beyond anything else with sandboxing. So many issues would have been preempted if Apple had sandboxed their own apps. And, you know, the irony is I know that some of those apps aren't sandboxed because they don't work when they're sandboxed. Well, that should be a very clear indicator. You're either crippling the system or you're forcing you're forcing apps to live in a ghetto where they're going to have to be distributed through some insecure distribution mechanism and put customers at risk. And as a result, not be the potential successes that they could be and not help the platform in the way that they could help the platform. Apple needs to face this reality. They can't, they should sandbox all their apps. They must sandbox all their apps, and they must not sell the unsandboxed apps on the App Store. They need to face the same problems that we face. I don't think they will, but it's, until they do, we're going to be in a different category that is just by its own nature going to be much more frustrating.
I totally agree, 100%. But what I'm saying is that it gets back to that animal husbandry thing that the jury was talking about, which is Apple does what's best for Apple.
Oh, yeah.
And they do what's best for their customers. And you have to play along.
No, it's totally true. And those
and are so they will sell unsandboxed apps because that's what's best for them. Yep. And you're stuck in the sandbox.
Yep.
And complaining about it is, I know a lot of people who work at Apple. They care about this kind of stuff. They're not tone deaf. They do understand it. But as an organization, it's like, wow. This doesn't really affect us.
Yep.
We'll get to it eventually, but this is not, we're not going to lose 5 million iPhone sales. So call us next week,
And honestly, were I in the same positions, were a director in charge of these applications or these technologies or a VP or anything like that, I'd probably make the same decisions. It's the right thing to do for Apple. It's just being on the other side of the fence, it's frustrating.
Oh, it's totally frustrating. But I do think that it's important to sort of put yourself in that position. What would you do if you were in charge?
I kind of, exactly.
Yeah, I know. It's just why I can say this to you. It's like, I would kind of be a dick. Sorry. It's like
the good of the many guy.
If you're going to put it like Spock and be all nice, I mean, sure. But it's important to understand the framework in which these decisions are made.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Because it's not one of like, I'm going to screw you. It's a self-interest.
They're an organization. Every organization exists to perpetuate and extend its own interests, period.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's just the name of the game.
And I think once you understand that and you've sort of set your expectations, you get happier, or at least you don't get so pissed off when things kind of go south.
You don't take it personally.
It's in balance.
Yeah, you definitely can't take it personally.
Yeah, that is very much true.
Yeah. Ryan, get off the phone.
Honestly, I
swear to God, there's another 3 hours in this.
Hey,
I have no idea how Renee is. Yeah, exactly. I have no idea how Renee is going to edit this.
Yeah, Renee, I apologize in advance I apologize in retrospect for the past 3 hours.
No, this is fantastic. I mean,
I honestly can't think of a section that's worth cutting.
I'm not going to cut any of it.
Yeah. We're going to have to slice
I'll
it.
Replay
too.
Part just, of it twice if I
you
can.
You know what? Just ship it. Just ship it.
Ship it. That's the only way to go.
3 hours. Yep. Yeah. It's organic.
Hey, it is.
What can you do?
It's an audiobook.
It kind of is at this point, honestly. I think my copy of Art of War is less than 3 hours.
Just to get it on record, Ryan, if people are interested in finding out more about you, more about your products and just stuff in general, where can they go?
Yeah, absolutely. So the products are Hype and Hyperflect. Hype can be found at tumult.com/hype. That's T-U-M-U-L-T.com. Tumult for those who are very anal about the pronunciation. And Hyperflect can be found at tumult.com/hype/reflect. And I can be found on Twitter at Ryan Nielsen, R-Y-A-N-N-I-E-L-S-E-N, and app.net on the same. And
don't check out the apps. Go buy it. Go buy it.
Yes. Buy two copies.
Give them to a friend.
Indeed.
Can you gift Mac apps yet?
No. No, you can't.
So vexing.
The Mac App Store.
All right. I'm stopping recording.